is no place to escape to.
This is the last
podcast. On the left.
From your glade.
That's when the cannibalism started.
What was that?
Oh, yeah! How you doing, Henry?
I am fine, Ben.
That's good, Henry.
I feel good. This is my new genuine voice.
That's great, Henry.
Hi, my name is Henry Zebrowski.
Reprogrammed Henry Zebrowski.
Hi, I'm ready for the masses, Henry Zebrowski.
That's great. Welcome to the show, everyone. That's Marcus Parks. I'm Ben Kissel. I have big news for you, Marcus.
Oh, yeah?
Henry Zebrowski's changed. He's going to be a star.
Henry Zebrowski, sponsored by Zantac. Have you been having pizza for dinner?
I have.
You been having Italian sausage for breakfast?
Yes.
Enjoy yourself a Zantac so you can enjoy your afternoon meeting with the people that you hate.
I thought I was going to be fine. I thought I was healthy and that trustworthy until that trustworthy voice came over and told me I have stomach problems.
You do.
Wow.
It's the stomach problems that are problem-ing your stomach. It's not the food that you're eating, or the coffee that you're drinking, or the beer that you drink in order to go to sleep at night, or the weed that you smoke to go to sleep at night, or all the different things you do to push down the idea in your head of grabbing a scissor out of the office desk, going down to your boss, and just stabbing him in his eyes. You don't even think about that. Try Zantac.
All right, someone get in here and reprogram Henry Zebrowski. He's off the rails.
Oh, I'm back.
People think
I'm back. I'm sorry. I've just been, you know, been a shill.
Yeah.
For a long time out here. But it's been cool. I've learned a lot on the other side. That's what you people don't understand, is that sometimes you got to be a shill.
Right.
And you learn something from the other side. You know what I've learned is?
What?
You know the thing about shills?
What?
They get paid?
They get great espresso machines.
Right. Espresso machines. They pay you in human gasoline.
Yeah.
That's great. Of course, Charles Manson, episode 3. Let's get into it, Marcus.
Yeah, our 150th episode, by the way.
Oh,
and
not only
that, but it is today. Today is Charles Manson's 80th birthday.
And now, so the Happy Birthday song is copyright.
Yes.
Right? So I can't sing the Happy Birthday song.
No.
We can
sing, so
like,
I can't go like, Happy Birthday to... I can't do that,
no,
right? Because
no.
I'll be... So we should sing a different sort of birthday song to Charles Manson. And I think it's going to go a little bit like this. Hey, happy birthday, Mr. Manson. How you doing?
Good,
I'm
good.
Stuck in here. Happy birthday, Mr. Manson. And that's it. That's all I
love that song. And then Charlie even got a little cameo in there. What was that? I'm stuck in here, he said?
I'm stuck in here. Ah,
you're stuck in there.
I'm just on a tarantula's trip, man. I'm living a spider's life. Don't worry about me, buddy. I'm sitting in my web enjoying my... I'm enjoying my cage.
He's like a little parakeet.
80 years old, though. Can you believe it?
80.
That's a difficult... he's past the life expectancy by 4 years, the average life expectancy.
There's rumors that he's in the hospital right now.
Living the dream, getting a cake delivered to him.
Yeah. He's supposed to be sick right now. I'm going to send good vibes out to Charles Manson. I hope he's feeling better.
Mm-hmm.
I hope he gets this podcast sent to him.
Oh, he
I know
will.
That we're technically fighting for you, Charlie.
As
technically.
Life, you know?
Today's podcast is, we've been kind of, the theme that we've hit over the last couple of Manson episodes is that the idea of the Manson crimes is a lot more complicated than Bugliosi wants you to think it is.
Bugliosi.
We've been reading Manson in his own words. That's Manson's side of the story, even though that's also pretty, what's the term for that?
Fucked up?
Unreliable as well.
Yeah, something like that.
Unreliable narrator.
Yes.
Yes, and even after the book was put out, Charles Manson came out and was like, I didn't ever say that I was raped. I didn't say that I was raped. I didn't say that.
Mm-hmm.
I had a terrible childhood. And the interviewer's like, what is, why did you have a terrible childhood? He's like, child don't know what terrible is. He don't know what terrible
That's
is.
Right.
And she was like, but were you raped? He's like, nah, it was terrible.
There's a moment
it
in
was
this
terrible.
New, there's a documentary that came out like in 1997 that was called In the Mind of Manson. And basically he sort of admits, he's like, yeah, I'm the king of evil. If I get out of here, I'm going to kill everybody around me. You know, it's not like I'm in here and it takes two people to help me go to the bathroom. That's not what it's like. There is a difference between Manson's account of the events that happened and Bugliosi's accounts of what happened. And today we're going to try and find the middle ground. We're going to try to sneak around the truth, which is a little speech that Manson gave that we're going to play for you right now.
Look at the madness that goes on. You can't prove anything.
You can't prove anything. There's nothing to prove. Every man judges himself. He knows what he is. You know what you are, as I know what I am. We all know what we are. Nobody can stand in judgment. They can play like they're standing in judgment. They can play like they stand in judgment and take you off and control the masses with your human body. And they can lock you up in penitentiaries and cages and put you on crosses as they did in the past. But it doesn't amount to anything. What they're doing is they're only persecuting a reflection of themselves. They're persecuting what they can't stand to look at in themselves. The truth. Everything is sneaky up around Sneakyville. Everything we have to do is to get to the truth has to be sneaky. It seems a shame to sneak to get to the truth, to make the truth such an evil, dirty, old, nasty thing. We are sneaking in the county jail, looking under the door.
That's it. That's it, man.
I just feel like you could play that music in the background of any speech, and it would sound that intense. You could hear a hippo farting with that music in the background, and you'd be like, that's the most profound thing I've ever heard.
Yes, so we're going to be trying to balance the official storyline of the Manson murders with Manson's version of the story, because there is a true story in between the two.
Yes, there is. Yes. The something about this, you know, the helter-skelter thing doesn't add up. It's just a little too far-fetched. It's a little too smart for Charlie.
Charlie's not a big thing too is that they gave him a lot of credit.
So much credit. In fact, yeah. Bugliosi said that, like, one time Manson stared at me and my watch stopped.
And so come on.
Yeah, come on. Yeah, yeah. And Manson,
you could barely write a folk song.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, Manson, the only way I can stop a watch is if I step on it. Like, good. And Manson himself, he admits, he's like I'm a two-bit thief. I'm a thief that couldn't steal without being caught.
So theoretically, Bugliosi is saying that Manson has the power of, what is it, telekinesis?
Telekinesis.
And he used it to stop his watch.
Yes.
Yeah. Out of all the things that you could do with this super Professor X, ability, I'm gonna stop his watch.
I would go to the Publix and I'd find the girl behind the counter and I would lift her up above the counter and launch her pussy first onto my mouth.
Yes.
So where we left Charlie Manson last, he had just left Gary Hinman's house. Gary Hinman was the nice guy mescaline dealer that got mixed up with the Manson family and ended up murdered.
Is that on his tombstone? Nice guy mescaline dealer? Because I would love to meet him.
So after the Hinman murder, Charlie left the ranch. Right. He said, fuck it, I'm out of here. I'm going to go wander around.
Because all he talks about is like, you got to be there. You got to be there for the group. You guys really put, they look to me. I'm the fulcrum of the circle. I make sure people get what they want and get the fruits that they want. But I think I see a hint of bush hair behind that tree over there. There was a murder. I gotta get out of here.
As Jesus went to the Mount of Olives,
yeah.
So did Manson go outside in the desert.
So Manson, he decides he's going to try to recapture some of the spirit of a couple of years before when he was just wandering around California. And he really does. I mean, he's still got it. He picks up 17-year-old Stephanie Schramm from San Diego. Mm-hmm. And they just spent the next few days doing acid and fucking under the stars.
He went out looking, you were saying, for loose women in particular.
Loose women, yeah.
I want to know what was his signs. Like, he was like, not loose. Loose, definitely loose.
In 1969, it's if a girl is leaning against a telephone booth.
Loose? That's loose?
Every woman that he describes, basically every woman that he met that became a part of the Manson family, all were like, I just saw her there, like, leaning on a lamppost, and I went over and smiled at her, and I said, hey, you want to see a rainbow all trapped inside your sunglasses? And she was like, yeah, Charlie, that sounds like a hip trip. And so the way he got Stephanie Schramm is that he walked right up to her, and he's just like, so you're here with the old man? She's like, yeah, I'm here with my old man. He's kind of a rube. He's like, haha, why don't you drop out of that? Come with me on my trip, you dick. Be driving around, you know? Smell my armpit hairs. If you want,
I She's do, like, dig.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you?
What was every relationship from 1960 to 1971? Could you just take somebody from somebody?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
that's
it was
what you would do.
Totally accepted.
I mean, it depends. That's why you had to be real cool if you had a girl. Otherwise, a Manson type guy is going to come creeping up on you. You always got to be hip to the new beats, as they would say.
How lame do you have to be for her to look over and see this guy, like, skulking around a bush going, like,
You have to be her father. That's it.
Well, the guy who wrote Manson in his own words, this guy, Newell
Why
Emmons.
Why was it called Manson in his own words if it wasn't written by Manson?
Because it says Manson in his own words as told to Newell Emmons.
Sure.
So Newell, in the afterword to the book, he talks about one of the interviews that he did with Manson, and he brought a female reporter along with him. And he said the difference between Manson when he was by himself with Manson and when this woman was in the room, he said it was night and day. His language sweetened up a lot. His body language completely changed. And he said that he watched Charlie charm this woman. Just a regular reporter, you know, and a smart woman. He said that he watched her relax. She started to laugh at his jokes.
Because you know what I realized? When I was watching in Manson's mind, the mind of Manson, that documentary, I was like, he's just trying to joke with you, lady. Most of Charles Manson's stuff is him just trying to be funny.
Yeah,
when you listen to other gurus talk, I watched this documentary called The Source, and you listen to all these gurus talk about all this ludicrous stuff about flying in the air and it's a hip trip, it's a sex trip, baby. And they're all like literally going like, ha ha ha, they're laughing, it's joking around.
Yeah, Alan Watts, the same thing. I mean, his jokes are atrocious, and he's not necessarily a cult leader, but he talks in that same, like when they talk about this really heady stuff, they're making jokes the entire time, and Manson was no different.
So basically, it's like Manson, it's like me if I'm in a room without pizza, and then me when I'm in a room with pizza, because you can't not be smiling when you're holding a piece of pizza, because you know you're about to take a bite of it, which is kind of exciting.
That's very true. How that encounter ended is that he said that Manson walked around her, and he put his hands on her shoulder, and then he suddenly switched. And he grabbed a cord off of the table, and he put it to her throat.
No, Charlie.
He put it to her throat, and he said, what do you think, Newell? Should I kill the bitch? And then he started laughing and put it down. He's like, I'm just messing with you.
I mean, that's just
like, these are people who are jokers. That's funny.
That's what the amazing Jonathan, the great magician comedian, that's one of his bits. It's classic. Classic comedy.
So Charlie and Stephanie, after driving around and fucking through Southern California for a little while, they came back to Spahn Ranch on the morning of August 8th, 1969, and people were on edge. And before August 8th was over, five more people were going to be dead.
Is it the morning if you never fall asleep?
Yes, it's technically the morning.
It's still the morning.
He showed up literally doing the thing. It's like, I was expecting to see all my normal, like, smiling, happy faces to see me, but then everyone was all sad and frowning around, and I was like, oh, that's right, we killed a guy last night.
Oh, yeah.
Again, he needs a reminder. He needs an iCalendar.
Right.
Remember what you did. Just put a little note being like, remember that we killed that guy before you go on a bush hunt?
Yeah, usually you dig through your pockets after a hard night of drinking, you find a taxi receipt, and you're like, oh, $50 from Midtown. No, what a waste. He finds an ear.
We're going to start seeing Manson's point of view completely differentiating from the official story, which is now, so he shows up basically being like, hey guys, this is my new chick Stephanie, she's really rad, we did acid and balled all night last night, and they're all like, we finally figured out how to get Bobby. Basically, he shows up and they're like, Bobby's out of jail. Bobby's in jail.
Yeah, Bobby was the guy that killed Gary Hinman. He was found sleeping in Gary Hinman Fiat,
right. Because they found him dead, and then they were like, he has two, where are his cars? His driveway was empty. They found it, like, literally a couple of miles away because they're morons. Again, we're dealing with a group of total idiots.
Yeah, and the weapon was in the tire well.
And like, I want to say this, a bit off subject, my opa was the head of the union of Fiat. So that is true. He was the head of the union.
Did they make train cars?
No, they didn't. No, it wasn't. It wasn't a train. As a matter of fact, he purposely made it so couldn't fit a series of people. It was a small, relatively small car.
He was just following orders, I know.
No, he was giving certain orders to say, he said, stop it. My grandfather was a good man who said stop it a lot. Leave him alone! So anyway.
So basically, the Manson side of the story is that he showed up. They're saying Bobby's in jail, and we think we figured out how to get Bobby out of jail.
Yeah.
Really what I think of is a frog, Stephanie, in this situation. When you boil it in water, it doesn't know it's dying, but they just threw her right in.
Yeah.
She was just like, Jesus Christ, what the fuck? I mean, this woman must have been terrified.
Yeah, she got Manson kept her out of it. She had no idea what was going on.
Right.
Because she comes and he immediately shuttles her off into one of the outlaw cabins.
Because
she's like,
"So Charlie, which one of these buildings are we gonna live in?" And he's like, "I hate to tell her how like I'm gonna fuck her tonight and then pass her to like 9 other dudes, but at that moment in time, I really loved her." Yeah. So I said, "I'm gonna fuck you in all these shacks." He literally said, "I'm gonna fuck you in every one of these shacks, and then we'll pick our favorite." She's like, "Ah, Charlie, that's romantic.
That's actually
Can I have
nice.
Some more acid?"
That would be Henry. If you ever get into the real estate game, that's great. Fuck in every house that I show you, whichever one you like the best, you get to have.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so she was put off on another thing, but the whole time he was like, "She loved our rap. She loved what we were laying down." Mm-hmm. As soon as she saw what was up, because nothing more than a really beautiful 17-year-old girl loves than to see a bunch of just like absolutely filth-covered mongrels living all over each other in a shack city.
So according to Manson, you know, the girls have been talking amongst themselves as to how to best help Bobby. And so what they came up with, this is the best idea they could come up with.
They were so excited.
So excited about it. Of course, they've been on the Helter Skelter trip for a little while now. They'd been on, the Race War trip. Race War, a.k.a. Charlie's plan to get out to the desert.
Mm. And they were going to dig a hole in the desert and they were going to stay there until the Race War was over, then come out and help black people lead the world. But the problem was so that's the official line, and the unofficial line, remember, was that Manson said that he offhandedly talked about Helter Skelter just to dig himself out of a hole.
Yeah,
right.
Within the group.
I mean, that the biggest flaw in the entire plan is the idea that they're going to come out of the hole as disgusting looking white people, like creatures from The Descent.
Yeah.
And then black people are going to be like, "Oh, you were all right, white person."
No, it wasn't that. They expected to come out as far as, you know, according to Bugliosi, their plan was to come out and black people would go, "Oh, thank God. We have no idea what we've been doing."
We
have no idea.
White people. We thought we killed all of them. Oh, we regretted it. Oh, man.
Yeah, that was the official slogan.
Right.
What their plan to get Gary out of prison was, or not Gary, to get Bobby out of prison was, is that they were going to commit a whole other series of murders that were similar to the Hinman murders, writing things on the wall in blood like they had written Political Piggy on the wall in blood at Gary Hinman's house. That was the best they could come up with.
So literally Manson felt like, Sandra came up to him and said, like, "Charlie's exactly what you wanted. It's Helter Skelter, like you said." And he's like, "Oh, bitch, that's not what I wanted. Cash. I wanted money." "What do I got to pull? Gotta go play the tambourine and get my dick sucked. I gotta clear my head."
Yeah, and he tried to leave it. When they started telling him all this shit, he's like, "Fuck that! I'm out. He's like, "I've been to jail too many times. You girls are gonna get me right back into jail.
Right.
I don't like jail. I don't want to go back to jail. So I'm getting out of here." But Squeaky, she turned his words around on him. Where he was caught in a trap, he said, "No, you can't go. Love is one. We are one."
And that's what Squeaky said too. Is that he looked around the circle and he was just like, and at that moment in time, I was like, "Man, I need to get the fuck out of here. I'm gonna get a dune buggy and I'm gonna hit the—" But then I looked around and I remember each one of them. First time we bawled, first time we fought, first time I licked droplets of acid out of one of their belly buttons.
Right,
right. First time I spent an hour pulling body chiggers out of one of their butt hairs. I remember each time with them. And he literally was just like, "I can't leave them now. I gotta see this through.
Gotta ride this fucking train."
It's like the Goonies, man. You know,
normal profiling and people who've done drugs, where it's like you can see if you've done drugs together in a group of people for a long period of time, you do begin to develop sort of a group think.
Yeah.
And you do, and the group can move ahead of you.
Well, very underreported, Del Close, the founder of improv, was actually part of the troupe. And this is where it all began. They were just yes-anding themselves into oblivion.
So it's noon on August 8th. We're 12 hours away from the Sharon Tate murders, and they haven't even decided who they're going to kill, Who's going to carry out the murders? They haven't decided anything yet.
There's a rabbit running around with a fucking piping hot cup of tea being like, there's so many decisions, so little time. I mean, I can't believe they were able to handle the stress.
Stephanie's walking around just being like, where's the coffee maker?
Not now, Stephanie.
Coffee?
And so Charlie, he said, I'll stay, but what you do is on your heads, not on mine. It's all on your head.
Yeah, Charlie, you're going to get off scot-free.
Yeah.
Don't even worry about it.
Yeah, and they said, you know, and they all said, we understand, Charlie. There were hugs, there were smiles, there were kisses.
The way he diffused this whole scenario, he basically said that Mary and Sandy are going to take a couple of those stolen credit cards out, and they're going to buy everybody a bunch of gifts.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody likes gifts, right? What do you want? What do you want? He's like, I want a bow and arrow. Sure, yeah, whatever you need. Just get a bunch of teddy bears and some cotton candy, and we'll have a good night, all right? All right, let's break it up.
Yeah. So Charlie, he goes out in search of Tex, and he finds Tex Watson in the middle of an acid trip, sitting on an old couch, slapping his legs in time to music that only Tex heard.
Yep.
Yeah.
Love that song.
And, you know, we talked last week about the Belladonna, and Charlie had talked to the person who was actually making the tea, and had only taken a small dose, and she said that weeks later she was still feeling it. She said that she was having blackouts.
Jesus
that
Christ.
She was still, and Tex, he had picked up the baked potato and fucking eaten it like, or he had picked up the Belladonna and eaten it like a baked potato,
and now he's a rock star in his own mind.
Yeah.
So maybe he did it right.
It's about confidence.
Right.
Yeah. So by the time Charlie found him, Tex was, he had already heard about the murder idea, and he thought it was great. So Charlie told him, he says, Tex, you remember that black? Talking about Crow, he's like, you remember that black and what I told you when I came home after killing him? That life I took for you was your life.
But
Bobby is my brother. He is your brother. And right. To save our brother, I'm asking you for the life you owe me.
And then Tex was just like,
that's a lot of math,
first of
man.
All, I don't know why this lamp is talking to me. Second of all, I'm down to do whatever you need, Mr. Lamp.
Gotcha. If a lamp does start talking to you, follow whatever it says.
Yeah, and then Tex, he just sat back and said, I can handle it, Charlie. What do you got planned?
I don't have any plans. Is that- It's the girl's thing. Just so you know that. It's the girl. So, again, Manson hits us several times in his autobiography.
Yeah.
I'm not planning it. The girls are planning. They are planning it. They will do a thing. I don't know what it is. But I do know that they can't do it by themselves. Whatever they decide, they're going to need you, Tex. You're my go-to guy. Tex is literally like hanging from his feet from a chandelier. He's going like, I'm at the gym. Hey, Charlie, look, I'm at the gym.
So that night, it's about 8, 10 o'clock, still no plans, still like
describes his meal too when he's like, they all had a nice meal that Brenda cooked. And he's like, Brenda can just do some lip-smacking stuff with some dumpster vegetables. I can't even believe the amount of rocks that she can fit in that rock soup. We had a glorious time just bawling, smoking, living in each other's dreams.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was one finger prick away from being like, go feed Grandpa. I mean, it was like so disgusting the way they described that dumpster meal.
So call came in the middle of dinner, and turns out that going around and going on a shopping spree with stolen credit cards ain't a good idea. And
no, because Charlie literally said he forgot that the credit cards were stolen.
Yeah.
He thought
he got approved? he got approved by the bank?
He legitimately, there are several times when he talks about this stuff, and it's like he just legitimately forgets that they just killed somebody. It's like he's always just trying to make it okay because he's constantly validating his existence and saying like, no, this is good. This is a family we've built. This is the family I've always wanted that I've built. No, I'm a criminal mastermind. All of this is going to go to plan because it's good now because I'm on the right path.
And that's exactly what he told the Chase Bank officer when he went and requested the Chase Bank card. There's approved. That's
and
perfect.
And it's like, first of all, sir, I'm glad that you came over here. We want to help you. We're really happy to have brand new Chase customers at any given point. But if you could please put on some shoes, and if you could stop trying to finger bang the receptionist, that'd be really great.
Pre-approved.
So these girls get arrested, and for some reason, according to Charlie, after all the rejection, after everything that has happened to him, for some reason, this is the last straw for society. Society has taken away his women. He said,
what the fuck is happening here?
One by one, this fucked up society is stripping my loves from me. I'll show them. They made animals out of us. Let's unleash those animals. I'll give them so much fucking fear that people will be afraid to come out of their houses.
Yeah. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's really cool. Yeah. I mean, it's, you
it
know.
It did, too.
I will have my revenge.
Yeah.
I will have my revenge.
So he goes out looking for Sadie and Tex. It's 10 o'clock. 2 hours away from the murders, still no plan at all. He ran into his new girl, Stephanie, on the way, who has no idea what's going on. Right. He said that he walked her to her trailer and, quote, gave her a couple of kisses and a pinch on the tit and went back out for Tex.
And, you know, that's all it takes to satisfy a new woman that was made adhered to you by acid.
Yeah.
A pinch on the tit, huh?
Couple of kisses and a pinch on the tit.
Oh, my goodness. Well.
So on his way, he sees Big Patty lying on the ground. She's
like always.
Yeah.
She's trying to shake an acid trip from earlier that day. So Charlie kicks her. He kicks her and he says, get up. You're going for a ride with Tex and Sadie. And so he finds.
But I'm only medium rare.
Yeah,
sick
she's
of
just
the goddamn hamburger patty jokes, Patty. And will you just please do what I say?
Some sort of blubbery meat. Yeah. So that's terrible for that poor girl, though. She took acid in the morning, and then she had to go. She was dealing with the acid hangover in the back of this car, just being all big and sad.
This was one of the most active groups on acid I've ever seen.
I know.
They did everything on acid.
Right. Yeah. I mean, usually you can't do that. I mean, you stay in a confined space for a confined amount of time, and when you get out, you never want to go back. They never stopped.
Yeah.
You know what the thing is that it just proves still you can't do anything on acid.
Right. You can't, I mean, you can't get away with it. Yeah.
If they had just moved to the desert like he'd been talking about for 6 months instead of just building dune buggies for no reason, then maybe none of this would have happened.
Doom buggies were pretty cool.
It is pretty cool. So he finds Tex just wandering around by himself. Tells him it's time. He said the girls don't have a place picked
out.
How
did anybody connect?
What?
Everyone is always just wandering around or fat on the couch.
He didn't have a living room. He didn't have a couch.
So he tells him, he says, it's up to you where you're going to go. The girls have no idea what to do. He said, go get the bolt cutters for the phone and wires and fences. And Tex like, I don't know. I'm a little messed up, Charlie. I don't know where I'm supposed to go.
Let me just say, all right, now what's the difference between a house and a tent? One has a door, right? And what's the difference between like a normal house and like a gas station? What is a gas station?
Tex, I hate to say this, but you're hovering 8 inches off the ground right now, and what I'm gonna need you to do is to focus. Tex, get out of that tree. Tex.
Yeah, and Mancy, he just pretty much tells us, he's like, come on, Tex, you've been a lot of these rich guys' places. He's like, yeah, just go someplace like where Terry used to live.
Right.
And Terry Melcher. So with just an offhanded comment, where he's just like, yeah, like fucking, I don't know, Terry's place or something. With an offhand comment like that, that is how Sharon Tate and all of her friends were murdered.
Terry should have signed him. Terry
that is also
him.
The Manson's version of the story. Yeah. And the Bugliosi version of the story is that he came in. It was bump, bump, bump. He ordered everybody. He said, tonight's Helter Skelter night. We're going to Terry Melcher's house, and we're going to get revenge for him not producing my record. Mm-hmm. But I do also believe...
Oh, that is insane.
It's not only insane, it's also easily unproven because Manson knew that Terry Melcher didn't live there anymore. He had gone to the house
to go look for money like 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, when he was going around trying to look for his money, he went to the house where he thought Terry lived, and the groundskeeper is like, he doesn't live here anymore. Matt's like, give me the address. It's like, I don't know. Of course,
whatever you are, then crab human, absolutely not. I will not do that.
Then he robbed the groundskeeper and went away with bags and bags of grass, which was very sad.
This is also where a lot of the people who break down the crimes are ignorant of the entertainment business.
Yeah.
Because they really think that Terry Melcher just kind of heard it and passed in it and that they were not a part of each other's lives. When actually, when you read about their lives together, especially from Dennis Wilson's point of view, Manson traveled around a lot of musical circles and actually got relative, like they were listening actively to his music. They thought maybe it was a novelty that they could use, but people who are not entertainment don't understand is that you'll bounce around for months. This is not a simple revenge story.
Right. No.
They want it to be. They want it to be this revenge story, but it's not. It's just I believe that there's something that this is closer to the truth, that it was just like, yeah, go in my Jerry's house. Yeah. Yeah.
I think they were just looking to have something to do that night. And they're like, well, tonight's murder night. Oh, shit. We better plan that then.
Yeah. I thought it was Taco Tuesday. Man, what day is it?
It's Thursday.
What year is it?
So it takes them about 20 minutes to get everything ready, get everyone together.
That is record time.
Yeah, that's very quick.
Yeah, and Manson said that he thought back to just 12 hours earlier when he had showed up with his new squeeze. All of this happened in the span of 12 hours.
Where were we at in total time here? A year and 16 months?
About a year
months?
And a half, yeah. I'd say like 16, 18 months from the time he got out of prison until this point.
That's the one thing it's still difficult to understand is just how compact and compressed this entire story is.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah, and he, this is when, you know, and Manson, in his own words, he does admit to having responsibility. I mean, he considers himself responsible for the murders, and the fact that he said, I was so much a part of it, I might as well have been in the car with the others, knife and gun in hand. I was the one person who could have prevented that car from leaving Spahn Ranch, but so goes the feeling of power when coupled with hatred.
Yeah, and it is
kind
of fun.
Also, it just sounds like a young Adolf Hitler's quote as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the first five victims of the official Manson murders happened at 10050 Serial Drive.
Yeah. And you had Patricia Krenwinkel, Big Patty, Linda Kasabian, who had only joined the family the month before.
That is a rough time.
Yes.
That's the worst time. It's like joining SNL during the Billy Crystal years.
Very talented guy, Billy Crystal.
Susan Atkins, also known as Sadie, and Tex Watson. All on their way. The victims, first of all, Sharon Tate.
Do you think anyone farted in the car?
Probably, Ben.
Kind of funny, they smelled like farts permanently. Yeah. They were eating dumpster vegetables.
Right,
yeah. So, the victims, Sharon Tate, first of all. Sharon Tate, she was amazingly famous. She was, I'll put it this way, she was famous enough where I was talking to my mom about this last night. My mom was 14 years old when all of this happened. Mm. Lived in Jayton, Texas, middle of nowhere in the late 60s. She knew who Sharon Tate was.
Right.
Like, Sharon Tate
is also smoking.
Oh, yeah. Very good.
So her debut role.
She's dead now.
Yeah.
She died? How does this story end? Oh, don't tell me Sharon Tate's dead. I love her work.
So her first role was in a film called Eye of the Devil, which was a suspense film about a cult that performed ritual human sacrifice to guarantee a lavish grape harvest.
Mm. For grapes?
Grapes, yeah.
And it wasn't even for wine. It was for jelly.
Oh, isn't that Concord grape?
Yep, her second film was a vampire spoof called The Fearless Vampire Killers, a.k.a. Pardon me, but your teeth are in my neck.
Oh, that's funny.
A.k.a. The Dance of the Vampires.
She's dead now, though, right?
Yeah. Did she die? Oh, I hope she has a great... I think she's going to have a great career.
Yep. And it's while filming this movie. But by the way, the plot is she's kidnapped by a group of vampires and eventually rescued by a bumbling professor and his assistant.
Oh, I love that.
So it's while filming this movie that she meets her future husband, director Roman Polanski, right. Who's best known for Rosemary's Baby, Chinatown, The Pianist, and pedophilia later on in his life.
That's the other thing, too.
Yeah.
And it's like...
Pedophilia, the movie? Or the sitcom Pedophilia starring John Ritter there and
I also like
Charlie
in the 1970s,
Sheen.
Most actors and directors were like just borderline not criminals. It's like everybody. It was like you had like Robert Blake running around.
Oh,
and like Phil
Spector.
All these people that literally just beat the shit and threatened violence on every single person around them.
They all got caught eventually, though.
Yeah. And Polanski, of course, was completely shattered by this fucking event. He said that his absence on the night of the murders is the greatest regret of his life.
What was he going to do?
Die. He wanted
to
die.
If he was there, we would not have had the incredible Ninth Gate film with Johnny Depp.
Yeah, that's a good point. I love everything Johnny does.
And we definitely wouldn't have had Chinatown, which was in 74. And Chinatown was a fantastic movie. But he said in his autobiography, he said, Sharon's death is the only watershed in my life that really matters. And he commented on her murder. He said it changed his personality from a boundless, untroubled sea of expectations and optimism to one of ingrained pessimism, eternal dissatisfaction with life. Which caused him to have a sexual relationship with a 14-year-old gymnast named Natasha Kinski.
And Chinatown. Yeah, so that's good. He wrote a hell of a movie and directed it, too.
She was 26 years old and 8.5 months pregnant when she was murdered.
Sure,
next up was Wojciech Frykowski.
We'll go into what happened there with Sharon Tate. How'd they do it?
We'll get into
that. Oh, we're going to get into it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We're not just going to list the victims and then move on.
Oh, okay, good. Yeah, because that's very important stuff.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Frykowski and Folger. Frykowski was one of Polanski's childhood friends. Abigail Folger was his partner. She was heiress to the Folger fortune.
Right.
It was the worst
part of waking up, you know, the whole joke there, everyone.
They were at the house because they house sat for the Polanskis a lot, and Sharon's like, why don't you stay an extra couple days? Next one was Jay Sebring. He was a Hollywood hairstylist, very successful. He learned how to cut hair in the Korean War. He designed the haircuts.
That is very difficult with bombs going off back and forth. You have to be really good at cutting hair.
Oh, totally.
Yeah.
Henry, what are the odds Jay Sebring, the hairstylist, is straight?
It's 100%.
He was actually Sharon Tate's ex-boyfriend.
And was
madly in love with her until the day, and in fact died defending her. This is a super fucking creepy side story. So this is when Jay and Sharon Tate had both this is when they were still together. He bought a home in Benedict Canyon, and the house, extremely dark history. Gene Harlow and MGM producers Paul Byrne. Byrne killed himself in the house.
Mm-hmm.
And three other people would die in later years. One committed suicide, another drowned in a pool, a maid hung herself there. And Sharon says that in 1965, she was woken up in the middle of the night to see a little man by the bed, just kind of hanging out. And she's
Charles Manson. Yeah. Still just being like, hey, I'll see you soon. Bye.
Yeah, yeah.
And she ran out of the room and down the stairs, and tied to the foot of the staircase, she saw the body of a man with his throat slashed.
And then how did she react?
Oh, she fixed herself a drink and went back to bed.
Oh, okay.
What the fuck else are you going to do?
I don't know. Freak out?
And the last victim, or the last one we talk about, and the first
this
one
is
to
just
die,
a bad luck guy. This
Stephen
guy.
Parent, such a poor. He's like 17. He knew the caretaker at the Tate house, this guy William Gerritsen. He had come to sell Gerritsen an AM/FM radio, a clock radio, because he worked at a fucking electronics. He worked at a stereo store. And Gerritsen, the worst part is he didn't even sell the clock radio. Gerritsen didn't want it.
Oh,
so the last thing he did was he died a failure.
Oh, that's the worst.
It's terrible.
Very sad.
So he had a beer while they, you know, talked about the clock radio. He left around 2:15. He stops to push the button that opens the electronic gate. Standing there, Tex Watson got a long-barreled Western-style 22 revolver, the same weapon that they'd shot lots of Papa with. And in the other hand, the big fucking buck knife.
Right.
Watson shoots him 4 times, point blank in the face, making him the first person to die.
Honestly, yes, in that situation, I'm thinking, shoot me.
Hmm?
The idea of getting stabbed and murdered with a buck knife is much more terrifying than just getting shot in the head a couple of times. If I had to choose.
Yeah. If we all had to choose, we'd
and
all
Tex
go
Tex Watson's now on a full-on death trip. Tex Watson, we're going to see now, is definitely the fulcrum of all of these murders.
Yeah.
He really got into the role.
Yeah, he really
and
did.
And was technically very good at it.
Yes, he was.
Immediately. For a total dolt.
Yeah.
For a person who's like basically an unreliable piece of shit who could barely think.
Yeah.
Who was tripping balls the whole time.
Yeah, just, oh, man.
Yeah.
They were all tripping balls. Like, and that's a thing to keep in mind as well, is that at least half of the four were tripping balls the entire time this was happening.
So Linda, now these are the murders.
Yeah, Linda Kasabian, she drove him to the house. She was the girl that had only been joined the family the month before. She parks the car.
And she's the only one with a valid driver's license, and thank God, because they didn't want to get pulled over to get a ticket.
Exactly.
Yeah, they chose her because she was the only member of the family who had a valid driver's license.
Well, you don't want to go breaking the law. I mean, those laws are real. And
So Tex crawls out from the back seat. He climbs up the telephone pole, and he cuts the wires to the house. They then drove the car to the bottom of the hill and started to walk up towards the
house. And what's cool is that, not cool, I mean, cool, I'm disgusting, yeah. But it's like they literally parked it so they could make a quick getaway. Parked it like so it would just be driven off onto the road.
Yeah. Yeah, so they this is where they find Stephen Parent. They kill him. The
and
girls
he was just
push
like,
the car
hey
out
guys,
of sight.
Hey, guys, you guys going to like a party or something? Oh, man. Oh, dang, bro. You want like a clock radio? You want a clock radio?
Yeah, you should have tried to sell him on it. Maybe it would have worked.
So Frykowski, Sebring, Tate, and Folger, they were all asleep by this point, having stuffed themselves at a restaurant called El Coyote earlier that
now,
night.
And you can go to El Coyote, which is on Beverly Boulevard in Los Angeles, and you've gone several times. But every time you go, it's kind of a shitty Mexican restaurant, but it has it. But what they do is there's like a scam there where it's like people go in all the time, and they're like, hey, can you bring us the meal that Sharon Tate and all of them ate the night before they all got murdered, like right before they got murdered, and they just bring you the most expensive thing on the menu.
Ah, that's a very good idea. They probably did eat that.
So Tex finds an open window. He slices open the screen with his buck knife and then goes to the front door and lets Big Patty and Susan in through the front door. Frykowski.
Butter up the front door.
Yeah.
Now, what they talk about, too, with the idea that Sadie had or Manson had. It's one or the other. They talk about doing these crimes as witchy as possible.
Yeah.
Which I like that term a lot, because the idea I remember with all these crimes is that they are trying to inspire fear.
Yeah.
So it gets really creepy really fast.
Yeah. Frykowski gets woken up by Tex whispering to the girls, and the first thing he says is, "What time is it?" Tex sticks the barrel of the gun into Frykowski's face. He says, "Be quiet, don't move or you're dead." Frykowski asked him, "Who are you and what are you doing here?" To which Tex replied, "I am the devil, and I am here to do the devil's work."
Good line when you're on acid. Yep. Unbelievable.
Yeah. And Susan Atkins later on, she told Manson after they had gotten back to the house, she said that he really looked like the devil.
But then, but the first thing she said was, she's like, him standing there and he had that knife on and that gun on him and the rope on him, he looked like a real old Mexican bandolero. Like she also literally did say that.
Yeah.
That's great.
So Tex tells Atkins and Krenwinkel to search the house for other occupants. They come back with Folger, Sebring, and Tate.
And apparently, when Atkins walked the upstairs floor, she went and she saw, what's her name? Folger. She saw Folger in bed, and literally Folger looked up at her and just went, hi. And like, she was like, it's like she expected to see me, and I just waved at her and walked past, which is like this crazy thing. I guess in the 60s, you're just so used to maybe whacked out things happening, but literally this hippie woman just walking past the room and seeing you in bed and just waving at you and then walking past the door.
I mean, it's very possible that she just thought, it's like, oh, hey, that's a girl that Jay's fucking right now. I guess, she's coming over to hang out with Jay.
Right.
Which, you know, when you see someone walking by in a house where a lot of people are in and out, it's not the worst.
Oh, yeah.
It's not the dumbest thing. Yeah, you don't know who these people are.
Right.
She's like cute and young, too. So you're like, she's not here to kill me. Yeah.
Yeah. So they brought them into the living room. Tex ordered them to lie down in front of the fireplace, but Sharon Tate, she was 8.5 months pregnant, so she couldn't. So Sebring says, "Can you see she's pregnant? Let her sit down." And for his outburst, Tex shot him in the stomach. And
this is why you can't be a hero.
Yeah, and this is when they asked what the intruders wanted, Tex said, "You have to die to save my brother."
And then everybody, of course, goes apeshit.
Yeah.
Basically, as soon as he says that. Because up until this point, he's literally just telling them they want their money, they want their money, they want the money. Mm-hmm. And so they start going through, trying to take some of their money. And then finally, he's just like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do? And he's like, y'all going to have to die tonight. Yeah. And they just fucking flip out.
Yeah. Tex, he ties a rope around the necks of Sebring, Folger, and Tate on the advice of Charlie. He told him, he said, just make sure the girls
do it like Gary's house was done. Maybe even take some rope and hang somebody, like the reverse of the Ku Klux Klan thing. That way we'll put the heat on the blackies.
Yeah, he loves saying blackies.
Yeah, I mean,
blackies is a hard word to say.
Well.
Yeah, he says Whitey and he says Blackie. But yeah. And the other end of the rope was slung over a rafter. And then Tex ordered Patty to tie up Frykowski with a towel, which seems like a bad idea.
Yeah, they're not smart. Yeah. They're not smart.
Yeah, and so he walks over to Sebring, who's trying to defend Tate and her unborn child. Tex takes out his buck knife, and he stabs Sebring 7 times, the second murder of the night. And then Tex orders Patty to turn off all the lights in the house, and he took the other end of the rope that was over the rafters, and he pulled and caused the women to stand up to keep from being choked to death. And so Susan Atkins, she approaches Frykowski with the intent to kill him, but Frykowski, he's going into full-on freak-out mode because now 2 people are dead. He struggles free. He pulls Susan's hair as hard as he can, which sends her down.
Was it Glow? Gorgeous Ladies of Wrestling? Pulling them the hair. I mean, I feel like it could be something more aggressive.
Yeah, you'd think so.
Right?
You'd think
I'll pull her hair. That's what I'll do.
But in the moment, you know, you've got a hippie girl with a whole head of hair. You think first thing, pull it.
Sure.
Yeah.
You also, honestly, as a man, I've been trained my whole life to not hit a woman.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to hit a woman. But what all this lesson shows me is that if she's got a knife, you could sock her.
Frykowski, he runs for the door. He's screaming. And Tex goes after him. He stabs him and he hits him so hard over the head with his gun that it broke the grip. But Frykowski, he manages to make it through the door, screaming and yelling. And just down the hill from the house, a group of children from the Westlake School for Girls were camping with 5 counselors, and they heard Frykowski screaming as Tex caught up with him.
Yeah.
Like, they heard this guy dying. So Susan, she runs out of the house and she joins Tex as they finish the job, while the driver, Linda, she stood there just screaming at them, stop, stop, stop this. And Susan just turned to her and said, it's too late, and walked back into the house.
Oh, yeah, that's very late. It's very late.
Yeah.
I will say about that little girl, that the camping trip, is that, you know, it's kind of amazing they got to experience what it took my uncle a whole 4 years in Vietnam to experience.
Just right there. Yes. I couldn't help but think of that movie Troop Beverly Hills.
That was a hell of a...
Yeah.
So while all this was happening, Big Patty and Abigail Folger, who had also freed herself, they started wrestling, and after being stabbed multiple times, Abigail broke free and ran down the hallway. Krenwinkel followed with an upraised knife, finally tackled her on the lawn just outside of Sharon Tate's bedroom, and Krenwinkel continued to stab her over and over again until Tex came over to help, and she looked up at her killers, and this is what Patty remembers her saying.
Yeah, I remember her saying, I'm already dead.
She just kept saying it over and over again. I'm already dead. I'm already dead. Stop. I'm already dead.
Because she said also apparently, like, what she was doing too is that she was begging to be like, a part of her negotiating, because from Manson's own words, he got this whole story from Sadie when they showed back up.
Yeah.
And so Sadie came and told him this whole story, and according to her, Sharon Tate was begging to be like, you can take me hostage.
Yeah.
Take me hostage just so I can have my baby. Let me have my baby and you can have me. And you know, by this point, the train had already left the station.
Would have been kind of cool if Sharon Tate could have had her Patty Hearst moment, though.
Yeah.
Just, like, hung out with the Mansons for a while.
Can you imagine how happy Manson would have been?
Oh, my God.
Sharon Tate show up.
I get to bite another umbilical cord.
Oh, my God. That's all the guy was about.
It's been years.
Ooh, I love that people jerky.
Yeah.
So Sharon Tate, at this point, is the only one left alive. Atkins and Watson, they return from the front lawn, and she's just saying, please let me live. Please let me live. They ignored her, and they stabbed her 16 times as Sharon Tate died crying for her mother.
Because also, Tex Watson had been given the direct orders, apparently, from Charles Manson to make sure the women had something, that all of the girls were involved in the crimes. Mm-hmm. So basically, once they were even dead, Tex would pass the knife to the girls and be like, now you stab her. You stab her. So they will all be a part of it. So that's why these people had like upwards of 40 stab wounds by the time they found them, is because they were just hacking at dead bodies.
Yeah. So Krenwinkel, she grabs a towel on the way out, you know, acting on Manson's orders to leave a sign, something witchy. She picks up a towel, dabs it in Sharon Tate's blood, and wrote pig on the front door. And they were going to hang all of the victims.
They were
but
tired.
They said, quote, everything was too messy and we were tired.
Yeah, they got exhausted. It seems like a pretty tiring experience for all.
Yeah, try to get a bunch of hippies to finish a game of Cranium.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? It takes fucking... They don't want to do it.
It's not happening.
So on the way home, 45 minutes after they arrived, they stopped at a house and they used a hose to spray each other down. The homeowner, hearing them, came out and chased them away with a flashlight while his wife was yelling at him, going, "Dirty hippies, you sluts, you tramps." And they said they were just out there just playfully watching each other's hands and arms, and texted like, "I'm sorry, sir, we just needed to use your hose."
So Sharon Tate could have been alive if she had a flashlight?
Yes. Yes.
You,
they were
you gotta shine them?
Afraid of flashlights.
Right. Interesting.
So they get back in the car. They throw their bloody clothes, the gun, the knife out the window. They stop at a gas station to wash up a little bit further. And as Tex Watson, as he looked in the mirror at the gas station bathroom, he said that he was, quote, "trying to find out who I was. I wasn't anyone. I wasn't Charles Watson. I was an animal. The end of the world was there. I was
Tex
the living death."
Tex is such a piece of shit.
Yeah, he's such a piece. Tex Watson, he was the one, he immediately flipped on everything. He was the only one who tried an insanity defense.
Yeah.
He was the only one who was like, "I didn't know what was going on. I just was having drugs and having sex. And this next thing I know, I'm sticking a big fork into a woman's throat."
All of these people were a part of the same collective fantasy. This was Charles Manson was the fulcrum of it, and he was the inspiration for a lot of it. But all of these, they were active participants, and they made these choices.
Yes, they did.
They did the crimes. Yeah. You know, like, as much as Manson was a part of it and maybe drugged them and maybe, quote-unquote, brainwashed them, which I don't even fucking believe because he's kind of a moron, I think that they... This is all, this trip, it's just, you know, because we talk about the trains left the station. Yeah. It had been in the works for months. There's been so much negativity in the crowd of them.
Yeah.
That.
And this is what, and this is just what happens when there is a true unstable criminal mind at the front of all this groupthink. Of course, all of that, Charlie Manson, like the paranoia, but also just his general demeanor as a career criminal and as just a generally fucked up dude is going to seep into these other people.
It's going
right,
to.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. So we got these murders. Now they all just go back to the house?
They go back. Yeah. They just go back to the ranch. Charlie's
there. He's still squeezing tits and stuff?
Yeah. He's pinching titties.
He was saying that he couldn't even ball his woman that night. He was so concerned about what he had done and that he just sat and waited for the sun come up until the car pulled into the driveway.
Yeah. But he said when they got back and they told him about what had happened, he said he wasn't shocked. He said he didn't feel pity or compassion for the victims. The only concerns that he had is if the murders resembled the Hinman killing enough, and if the murderers had left any traces of their identities behind.
Right.
And also, none of them fucking... And they also didn't bring back any cash.
Yeah.
That's what he was like mostly pissed.
They brought back less than $100 cash and no drugs.
Oh my.
Yeah. That's what he was thinking.
Not even the placenta. Yeah. Huh?
Well, they didn't know who they had killed that night. They didn't know who they had killed until the next day when they were watching news broadcasts.
Oh, but that shit.
So that night they went out and he went back. So Charles Manson wanted to make sure that they had done everything on the fucking level.
Yeah, yeah. He went back. He wiped down the crime scene. He left an old pair of glasses on the floor.
He's like, this'll trick the cops.
Yeah, and we'll find out later, it did. Like, here's another one. I mean, once we get into the investigation, we're going to get into yet another case of gross incompetence on the part of the LAPD. But we're going to get into that much later. The next day, later that night, after dinner, seven members of the family dropped acid, hopped in a car, and drove around looking for more victims because... The police had made no link whatsoever between the Hinman murders and the Tate murders.
Mm-hmm.
So Charlie says, "All right, we got to go back out. We got to do it again. Second draft. Let's get it right this time. But this time I'm going to go with you because I'm going to make sure that it does right." Yeah.
Yeah. He wants to make sure you do it right. And so, like, they're driving around, but according to Manson's own words, he's just sitting there like, because, you know, again, he's always trying to explain himself as he goes. And he was like literally just being like, I just want to make sure we do this right and fast and cool and awesome. Yeah. But at the same time, but he's full of shit because he's not a murderer.
No.
Like, he himself is not a murderer. He's done every other crime under the sun, but he's never killed before. So a way to kind of like,
well,
think
he thinks he's a murderer at this point, doesn't he?
He thinks he can do it. Yeah. He's going out to get his hands dirty.
Yeah, but I thought the guy that he thought was a part of the Black Panthers, he thought that he killed him.
But that was it. We'll get into that. Yeah, right. Here in a little bit. We'll get into like his mindset as far as that went. They ended up after about 2 hours. They ended up in Los Feliz, which
Ooh,
is
a hipster.
Yeah, it's a hipster. Los Feliz.
Yeah, Los Feliz.
Yeah, Los Feliz. Yeah, hipster neighborhood nowadays. So they pulled up to the house, and the girls asked Charlie if this was the house, and they said, "Nah, I'm thinking about the house across the street," because they had just wandered into this neighborhood because they knew a guy that had that lived across the street from the LaBiancas, the victims in the second murder. And so Charlie, he took Tex up to the house. He found 45-year-old grocery store tycoon Lino LaBianca asleep with a newspaper in his lap. They entered through the back door. They woke him up. They told him, "We're not going to hurt you. Be cool. All we want is your money."
And so he tried to give them money. He gave them like 70 bucks that he had in his wallet. And then he was like, "Also, if you take me to my store, I can give you all my money. I can give you a shit ton of money." And they were like, you know.
Yeah. But they had learned the lessons from the night before. Like, don't tell them you're going to kill them.
Yeah,
you tell them you're going to kill them, they're going to freak out.
They're going to freak out.
Tell them you're there for the free sirloin.
So they tied Leno's hands behind his back with a strip of leather, asked him if anyone else was in the room, and he said, "Rosemary, yeah, she's back. She's asleep in the bedroom." So Manson goes back to the room. He pulls the covers off of her, and he says, "Wake up, lady. You got company." And so he moves her to the living room with Leno, and he ties her up as well. And Charlie, when he left the ranch, he was fucking geared up, man. He's like, "I'm going to get my hands dirty.
We're getting crazy.
I'm going to plunge a knife into a woman tonight, and I'm going to fucking kill somebody."
Sure.
But when he got there, he was faced with two people that were just sitting there passively in front of him. No aggression. They weren't trying to struggle free.
Yeah, so he's like, I need them to freak out so that I can go kill them.
Yeah,
like, I need them to do something so I can respond.
Yeah, he's like, I need the survival instinct to kick in, which was what happened with Crow, with the drug dealer. So he even goes as far as, like, he tells Tex, he's like, "Tex, take the woman to the other room. Take her over there." And Charlie purposely turns his back on Leno LaBianca,
hoping that he would attack him.
Hoping that he's going to fucking come in and Charlie can switch on and he can kill the guy and he can be a part of it too. But he couldn't do it.
Charlie's too busy thinking about slashing prices.
So Charlie, he leaves the house. He walks back to the car. He tells Big Patty and Leslie Van Houten, who is a new one.
He can't do it.
He just can't do it. He's just like, he's not a murderer.
And this one thing about Manson in his own words that I do appreciate is that it does, honestly, it makes him out to be a huge pussy. And he even says that. I mean, I hate to use the term pussy, but it's like.
You hate to use the term pussy?
No, I mean like he. It's not that he didn't have. He just didn't have the guts to kill somebody.
Yeah.
And so he.
Not
went
to say that it like
put
takes
it on the girls.
Guts to kill someone, but you either have murder in your heart or you don't. And
right.
Charles Manson didn't have it, so he goes back to the car where he finds Leslie Van Houten and Big Patty, and he says, "Go in, do it good. Make sure it's done so the pigs will put it together with him and that pad last night. We're gonna go find another house, and when you finish up, hitch back to the ranch, and we'll see you there." Because there were 7 people on this trip. So he sends 2 of them in with Tex and takes the other 3. And he's asking him, "All right, who do you hate? Where are we going to go?" And this one guy's like, "Well, there's this guy out in Venice Beach that I don't like very much." So
yeah, and then one of the girls and the other one was just like, "And there's this guy that, like, wouldn't make it with me once. Let's go get him."
Yeah. So they go out to Venice Beach.
It's like, "I hate to say it, Big Patty, but you're an acquired taste. I love it. I love you."
So he goes out to Venice Beach, and he's come down from the acid because he was on acid this entire time. Of course,
yeah,
they all were.
To pump himself up.
Yeah, to pump himself up. That sheen is worn off. He doesn't feel invincible anymore. So he sends the other 3 into the apartment complex, and then he says, "You know what? I'm going to go home. So yeah, he just
and then he
leaves
goes to like a Del Taco and he gets a bunch of chicken tacos. He just basically went and he says like, and then, you know, I checked out Rosemary's Baby and I was like, I can't believe we killed that bitch. She's like, I can't believe this is amazing. You know, I'm, oh man, you know what I need right now? Some saltwater taffy. Where can I get that?
So back at the La Bianca house, and these murders are, I mean, the Tate murders really get a lot, all of the press, but the La Bianca murders are a little bit more brutal.
Pretty brutal.
Yeah, they're pretty brutal. So Susan Atkins and Leslie Van Houten, they've joined Tex and Sidon. They've focused their attention on Rosemary, and they had taken her, who had been taken into the bedroom. They heard screams from the living room as Tex stabbed Leno, ended it with a cut to the throat, and Rosemary, who was given a rush of adrenaline by the screams of her husband, she attacked Leslie with a big-ass table lamp. And during the struggle, Leslie just kept saying, please be still, please be still. And so Patty, she comes back from the kitchen with knives, and she helps Leslie in the fight against La Bianca. Patty draws first blood, stabbing Rosemary in the back, which severed her spine. And Leslie later said at first she didn't want to do it. She didn't want to stab her. She said the more that she did it, the more fun it was. She said, quote, I was obsessed with the knife. Once it went in, it just kept going in and in and
in. She was also tripping balls.
Yeah, she was tripping balls.
So
yeah.
I remember watching Amelie four times in a row. You know, I was also way into that.
Yeah.
And by the end of it, Rosemary had been stabbed 41 times.
Yeah, it was bad.
Yeah. That's a lot of
stuff. And so then they learned, basically, Charlie gave them a whole lesson. Like, basically, you got to wipe stuff down for fingerprints. So they clean the whole place, and then they went as far to open all the drawers and wipe down the things they hadn't even touched because they're morons. So they probably put prints on them. Patty came and led them back out to the living room. She saw what Tex had done to Leno. He had been stabbed 14 times. A double-pronged carving fork was stuck into his fucking stomach, and a knife had been left plunged into his neck. And on his forehead, Tex had carved the word war, which is intense.
Yeah.
And on the walls, Patty had written death to pigs and rise. And on the fridge, she had written Helter Skelter, misspelled the fucking name of the supposed inspiration, Helter Skelter. And apparently, Helter Skelter, the words Helter Skelter were written all over the ranch. It was everywhere.
Right.
And yet, she still misspelled it.
Come on, just write it on your hand.
It's just easier to
stay focused.
She made it more difficult than it had to be.
Much more. So the three took showers in the house, and they hitchhiked home.
If she got that as a spelling bee, like, that would be great. Helter Skelter. Can you use it in a sentence? You've just murdered a family. You want to write on the refrigerator. H-E-A. No. Oh, damn it.
Charles Mance has been there. He has a big, like, sign in the back, like, go Patty, you know. He's just like, God damn it, Patty. That was in your... How many drills do we have to run? Note cards do we have to go through?
Oh, man.
So they hitchhike home. Charlie's waiting there for him. And over the next week, you know, just Los Angeles is going fucking insane. And Charlie said, the more the media sensationalized the crimes, the wider the grin got on my face. But still, after both murders, no connection whatsoever had been made between the Hinman murder and these two murders. And not only that, but this is absolutely fucking baffling. The cops made no connection between the Tate murders and the La Bianca murders.
Well, wasn't there a thing where they thought it was a copycat killer?
They
didn't investigate serial crimes.
Yeah.
This was before the idea of the serial killer still.
Yeah,
they didn't realize that someone would do something like this.
I think that they thought it was in the papers the next day, they said it was a copycat killer with the, you know, after the La Bianca murders.
Well, the Tate murders, they originally thought that there was some sort of drug. They were looking for the drug connection. That was the whole thing. Right. This has to be all about drugs. But with the La Bianca one, they just didn't, you know, they had no idea.
What was also interesting about the murders, too, is how it affected the Manson family, but how then it divided the group up between those that had committed murders and those who hadn't. And those who had committed murders were just sitting around the radio listening to the reports over and over again and just, like, whispering amongst each other, when you got Stephanie hanging around just being like, so when are we going to have a barbecue?
Right.
Are we going to, like, sing some songs or something? Charlie, you said that I was going to be a recording superstar.
Yeah, and there were 25 others just like her you know, the 25 others that had no idea that these perpetrated these murders.
Because Squeaky didn't even. Squeaky, the most notorious of all of them, is just also just still just sitting around, just like waiting, to like trimming her bush and just wondering when the next ball session's going to be.
So Charlie, he had no idea what to say. I love this quote from Charles Manson.
Hey, don't feel like you're being left out of anything. All those girls are whispering about has nothing to do with you. It's just that 8 people are dead and the rest of you aren't supposed to know about it.
Uh-oh.
So finally, the long-delayed move to the desert was underway.
Now they're finally going to the desert.
And Charlie said, except for time out for music and sex, we worked at getting ready for the final move.
Why did you take any time out? You just killed 8 people. Well. Just get to the fucking desert. He's so stupid.
Yeah, so but before that could happen, police raided the ranch for an entirely different reason. They raided them for stealing VWs and turning them into dune buggies.
Absolutely, they're literally just starting to like. They're like, look at this group of people just living on this fucking like plot of land. We should find a way to arrest them.
Yeah,
like what are these? Let's arrest these.
Yeah, but the thing was that the charges were actually dropped 2 days later because the cops had written the wrong date on the search warrant.
Ah, all right. Well. No traffic violations, so that's good for Charles. No one gives him enough credit for that.
Well, Kasabian had no points on her license.
Yeah.
She was great.
Yeah.
But it was very clear to Charlie that the cops knew the layout. They knew all the secret hiding places that they had. They knew all the escape plans that they had. So Charlie knew that someone had snitched. And because he was utterly convinced that nobody in the family could have been involved, he decided that it had to have been one of the people who worked on Spawn Ranch. So he eventually settled on a stuntman named Donald Shorty Shea, who took care of the horses. Shea and Manson, of course, they hated the fuck out of each other because it's Manson versus a cowboy. And I don't
Manson's a fake cowboy, and Shea is also a fake cowboy, but taller.
Exactly. And George was actually on the verge of selling Spawn Ranch because he was old and blind. And Shea, of course, thought, you know, it's the best interest of everyone to get these fuckers out of here. So Charlie, around August 28th, 1969, about 20 days after the murders, Tex, Bruce Davis, Steve Grogan, Bill Vance, Larry Bailey, and Charles Manson, they all took Donald Shea out for a ride. And from the backseat, Grogan struck Shea with a pipe wrench while Tex Watson started stabbing him. Then the group took Shorty out of the car, brought him down a hill behind Spawn's, and stabbed him to death.
And this is one of the murders that Charles Manson was actually convicted of. They said that he killed him. And again, Charles Manson vehemently denies that he actually killed him. He just said, I was there. I didn't break any rules. Is it against the law to stand on a tract of land in your moccasins? And I did nothing.
So Shea's body wasn't found until December of 77. And Grogan, he actually drew a map for police to Shorty's remains because there was a rumor going around that they cut him into 9 different pieces.
Oh, wow, that's a lot of pieces.
9.
Yeah.
9.
So Manson, he said that he can't clear up any details about it without being a snitch himself. But he said that Bugliosi, he said, caught up in his own helter-skelter hysteria, overlooked many participants, accessories, and conspirators. Someplace out there in that society he protects so well, he has left several killers to prowl the streets.
Right, right, right.
So Manson said that whoever murdered him, still out there. So after they got arrested, Charlie said, you know, it was not hard at all to convince people to get the fuck out of there and go to the desert. The paranoia got even higher. He got strict. He pushed the family into just being combat ready at all times. He pushed for, quote, vigilance, secrecy, mobility, and contempt for anyone outside.
Honestly, Manson says that he felt a lot of guilt about this whole time period, about basically, it's what he said. He's always been searching for a home and for a family and for a sense of peace. And now the whole thing has gone wacky woo on him. And he doesn't know, like, he just doesn't know how to stop it. Yeah. He doesn't know how to stop it. The whole thing's been cycling out of his control for a long time. And, you know, he's a fucking moron. He's just no good at it. Yeah. He's no good at being a cult leader. All these cult leaders. They don't realize how much work it is.
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
It never lasts.
Right.
So the sex, by the way, he said that it moved from free-flowing pleasure into aggressive lust. The music stopped altogether.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And as the weeks in the desert passed, a lot of the family just kind of drifted away. And they only moved around at night. And the locals, they noticed them. They noticed these fucking weird-ass hippies just skulking around all night long.
No, this thing has been waited to get busted for so long.
Oh, so long.
I can't even believe that they've lasted for as long as they have up until this point, because they're just a menace. They're just out all night smoking weed, doing drugs, probably screaming and laughing and playing music, and they just got like surrounded by neighbors.
Yeah. And so the cops raided Baker Ranch. They finally figured it out. Raided Baker Ranch for auto theft and possession of firearms. But Charlie was away. And again, he was away. But the second raid that they did would be the last day Charlie Manson would breathe air as a free man. When the cops busted in on October 12th, 1969, 2 months after the murders, they found Charles Manson curled up in a small cabinet beneath the sink. In his haste to hide, a few strands of his hair made their way outside of the drawer, of which an officer noticed. And later, the arresting officer said that if it wasn't for the hair, he wouldn't have ever looked in the cabinet, because he said it looked too small to hide in.
He's like Terry the Gnome. He's literally just like, yeah, I got his head hide this acorn. It's, oh, shit, oh, I forgot. This is my fucking toilet acorn. Oh, shit, fuck.
Oh, poor Charlie. Wild hair did him in.
He also had a very special it was a getaway spaghetti pot that he could also crawl into. So small and cute.
Yeah, tiny, adorable Charles Manson.
This is a much heavier episode than the other two episodes. Yes. I just also want to remind everyone.
Yeah. The other two episodes was a lot of, like, free love. But this is when, much like the Manson family, this is when shit turns dark.
Right.
So
he got arrested because his hair was poking out there.
His hair was poking out. And how the LAPD finally put everything together was for months they had no leads whatsoever. They had no idea what was happening. But when the Manson family had been arrested in that raid earlier that month, they were so fucking overjoyed that they were being arrested for auto theft instead of murder that they all started singing. Naturally, they started singing what they were listening to most at that time, which was songs from the White Album.
And which is also just, it's still ridiculous. And in the same, so when they showed up, because they didn't realize that Helter Skelter was literally written all over the entire fucking camp that they were living in. It's so ridiculous. So what happened here? So they were sitting in jail. They think they're there for traffic. They're being told that they're finally for a traffic violation. So they're fine. So the LaBianca team searched police records and came across the Hinman murder, right?
Yeah.
Because they figured out, like, someone had mentioned it at some point.
Yeah. And so what they did is someone finally saw the similarities. At the very least, saw that there was a gruesome murder in which somebody had written a message in blood on the walls. So they think, okay, we've got nothing else. Let's look into this. And they also were looking at the Helter Skelter angle of it, because this is the LaBianca team. So they start cross-referencing people that had been arrested in that raid with a list of people who had been questioned in the Hinman murder. One of the people they had questioned
was... It's like, this guy is guilty for stealing a bunch of licorice from a candy store, or this guy is arrested for being too groovy at a stoplight. I think we got our chain of events here.
So the name they finally came up with was actually Bobby Boussier's girlfriend, Kitty Lutsinger. And so Lutsinger, she knew nothing about the actual murders themselves, but through what she talked about, they followed up leads that led him to biker gangs who Manson had tried to hire as bodyguards, and Manson had alluded to the murders several times when they talked to the biker gang. At least he didn't actually say, listen, we killed a bunch of people and we think the Black Panthers are going to come down on us, so we're going to need to hire you. He didn't say, but he alluded to it enough where they got a hook in him.
Charles Charles Manson's problem, which we're going to see later on too, is the fact that he wants to appear to be this hardened criminal.
Yeah.
He wants to appear to be this fucking evil kingpin. So of course he's going to throw around all this evil shit around a bunch of these bikers because he wants them to respect him. Because again, you've got this fucking gnome dude trying to like get your confidence and be his bodyguard. You're going to want to brag a little bit.
Yeah. And so on, but what really did them in more than anything was Susan Atkins, Sadie, always known to have a big mouth. She started bragging to her cellmate that she was a part of the Tate and LaBianca murders. And that's when everything just came tumbling down. So on December 1st, arrest warrants were issued for Tex Watson, Patricia Krenwinkle, and Linda Kasabian. All three were quickly picked up. Physical evidence started rolling in. Fingerprints were found at the Tate residence because, amazingly enough, Charlie had, you know, missed a couple when he went back for the cleanup job.
I don't know how. He's such a thorough guy. And they also took all, when they left the scene of the crime, they literally took off all the bloody clothes and the knife and just threw it out in a field.
Yeah. And they found
that. So they found all of it.
Yeah, that got found real quick. And the Texas revolver, that was found by a 10-year-old kid. And so Sandra, working through her attorney, she sold a story called Two Nights of Murder on December 14th, 1969 for the Los Angeles Times.
And you're going to see a lot of this now where all of these people are quickly separating themselves from the crimes as fast as humanly possible.
Yeah.
And so she said, and then I love Charlie's response to this. It's like, this girl who had perhaps taken more drugs, created more scenes, inflicted more stab wounds, possessed the most perverted fucking imagination, and desired more attention than anyone among our circle, told a story that projected me as love itself, magic music maker, a devil, a guru, Jesus, and a man who ordered her and others to kill. Shit. If there was any truth to what I was said of being capable of, I'd have been sitting in Hearst Castle with stereos in every room listening to my own platinum albums.
Which is a fucking great point.
He was not that charming. He was a little maniac and a piece of shit.
So by the time Charlie hit the courtroom on the first day in June 15th, 1970, the whole myth of Charles Manson, the monster, the mastermind, the man who took everyone's young, the man who could take your young child and, you know, turn her into a murderer, that was established. Everyone knew that Charles Manson was a monster.
And that was the genius part of these defense attorneys. It was lawyers and publicists who, like, figured out how to spin this whole fucking story. Charles Manson, again, is not innocent. But he's not the devil himself.
No. So the prosecution's main witness was Linda Kasabian, who flipped immediately on everyone because, of course, she did. She was only there for less than a month, and she was just the driver. So she flipped because she got immunity from the prosecution. So she was the star witness against everyone in this. And Manson, Atkins, and Krenwinkle, they'd all been charged with 7 counts of murder and 1 of conspiracy. Manson was, and God, I wish they would have let him do this. Oh, they originally allowed him to act on his own defense, but due to a submission of, quote, outlandish and nonsensical pretrial motions, the permission was withdrawn before the trial started. And denied.
I imagine him showing up in one of those like English barrister costumes and being like, all right, so I got my lawyer wig. Next thing I need is, all right, I need about 5 or 6 tubs of beer. I need literally bathtubs filled with beer. And then the next thing I'm definitely going to need is a rock to sit on because I've kind of not been sitting on chairs for a while now. So if you could just get me like a sharp rock that I could put my little bony butt on, that'd be great.
So denied his right to represent himself, Manson showed up the first day of trial with an X on his forehead to represent that he was, quote, considered inadequate and incompetent to speak or defend for himself and had X'd himself out of the establishment's world.
Oh, he's not inadequate. He could do it.
He really could
have done it.
If they would have given him the chance.
Would have been, he would have been better than Bundy, I bet.
Definitely more. I mean, he probably wouldn't have worn a Seattle Supersonic sweater at any point during his trial. Well,
tell the jury they're beacons of light.
Maybe if he had known what the Seattle Supersonics were,
right,
he would have had the jersey on just because he's just like, what is basketball?
So by the second day of the trial, all of the other defendants all had an identical X, along with all of the family member protesters that were outside. Because remember, only four of the Manson family had been arrested. So there's still plenty of other girls and dudes out there still preaching Manson's word, but there were three, and really in particular two, Sandra Good and Squeaky Frome, that really stood by him and really took it upon themselves to spread Charlie's words, because...
And Squeaky was fucking supportive of Charlie 10 years after.
Oh,
because
God.
She had nothing to do with the murders. Yeah. This is what we talked about before. All the ones that didn't go to jail or weren't a part of the original murder scenes, they still loved the whole fucking free love thing. They loved what they were doing.
Oh, yeah, because Charlie, that whole trip as far as protesting and all that, they started that because of a bad jailhouse visit with Charlie, because he was pissed off at him, because Squeaky and Sandra were the ones that convinced him to stay that morning. The ones that said, don't go, Charlie, don't go. Like, we need you here. We are one. Because Squeaky was a true blue fucking believer in all of Charlie's peace and love bullshit.
Yes.
Like, she was the true blue believer. So they responded to him blaming them for that. They said, we'll tell the whole world about your good, your love. We'll make them see that you're not responsible. So that is when the spectacle of the Manson girls began.
And this is amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So this is a clip from Squeaky Frome asking about how, just pretty much how people are treating them outside.
She was asked how all the publicity affected her.
A lot of pushing for something that people want, you know, and we got it, you know, but they can't grab at it, you know, they just have to be patient and give, and it's in everybody.
Oh, very odd.
It's in everybody.
Body.
Kind of, yeah.
God, she must have been fun at a party, though. Like, you know what I mean? Like, she must have been like a fun, like, you kind of get trapped for a little bit, and you're just like, God, you're cute. This is great.
Yeah, so but the people on the outside, they were also trying their hardest to intimidate former family members from testifying. Both prosecution witnesses Paul Watkins and Juan Flynn, who was a ranch hand, they were both threatened, and Watkins was actually badly burned by a fire in his van. And former family member Barbara Hoyt, who had overheard Susan Atkins describing the tape murders to Ruth Ann Morehouse, agreed to accompany Ruth Ann to Hawaii.
It's just so strange of all places. Why would you go on a vacation with each other? Like, why? Why go now? It's the same Manson thing. I'm like, why are we going on vacation right now?
So what they did when they got to Hawaii is they took a hamburger that Hoyt was eating and spiked it with LSD. And, of course, they gave her way too much acid.
A whole hamburger's worth?
A hamburger's, wow. A hamburger's worth of
acid. My favorite amount of LSD is the hamburger's worth.
It also sort of reminds me of the scene from Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah.
When they put the hot sauce. Peppers on the burger.
How'd they know I have gas?
But she wasn't, actually, she wasn't intimidated into it. And she, before, she was a reluctant witness. But after they gave her the acid burger, she completely, she's like, yes, absolutely, I'm putting these fucking people away. And it's also rumored that the Manson family killed Leslie Van Houten's lawyer, but his death was eventually ruled accidental, that he drowned in a flash flood. But there are some people who very much maintain that he was killed for not following Leslie's instructions, which, of course, also... But, I mean, some people say that the instructions came from Manson. Manson said that the instructions didn't come from him.
From him, yeah, of course.
But on October 5th, Manson was denied the court's permission to question a prosecution witness.
Because he kept saying, like, I must ask the hard questions. Who is your favorite rubber human being? Is it Jim Carrey or is it Gumby?
Yeah.
I will ask Gumby. The good questions. What's your favorite burger? Is it In-N-Out or is it Fatburger? Come on. The jury needs to know.
So Manson, he gets pissed off, and it said that he left over the defense table, but I would imagine it was more of a skitter.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, more like a jumping spider.
Mm-hmm.
But the judge, on the other hand, he was scared enough where he had a revolver under his robes at all times. And it was also creepy, as Charlie was being wrestled to the ground, all of the girls stood up and started chanting in Latin, which is...
What were they chanting?
Domini est omnibus.
Was it Latin? I mean, I don't know.
Angelus Domini.
That sounds good.
So, on November 16th, the prosecution rested. And 3 days later, strangely enough, the defense rested as well. They called no witnesses to the stand whatsoever. And the defense lawyers say that was because they didn't want the girls to go on the stand to try to remove all the blame from Charles. Because by this point, Susan Atkins had switched back to Charles Manson's side. She had started off denouncing...
What a group. What a mess. Oh. What a group of fucking total messes, constantly.
Oh, what a gigantic mess. While the Hinman copycat defense, it was tried, it didn't work, and on January 25th, 1971, guilty verdicts were returned against the four defendants on each of the 27 separate counts. Watson, who was tried separately, was found guilty as well. And so Charles Tex Watson, Patricia Big Patty Krenwinkle, Susan Sexy Sadie Atkins, Leslie Morningflower Van Houten, and Charles Pussy Wizard Manson were all sentenced to death. But less than a year later, all the sentences were reduced to life in prison after the death penalty was abolished in California. And all of them, except for, I believe, Susan Atkins, are still alive to this day.
And now we have the best version of Manson, which is in jail Manson.
Oh,
Manson in jail is like Richard Pryor live. It's like fucking George Carlin. Like, why? Like, how'd I get here? The Jersey special. He is so awesome in jail. And the reason why is, too, is when you watch him and you see all these crazy fucking speeches he gives and he's always nuts and dancing around, is that he's having fun, number one. Number two, he finally has fulfilled his childhood dream of being the king of jail.
Yeah.
It's like what he's always wanted.
Yeah.
Now he's the scariest dude in jail. He's got the biggest rep. He could do whatever. He's totally comfortable. He's got people taking care of him. He's got health care. He's got a fucking a toilet. He didn't have a toilet on the Spahn Ranch for 2 years.
And yeah, and we're sitting here, we're making fun of Charlie. You know, we made a lot of jokes about Charlie. But yeah, so like, what do you think Charlie would say about all this?
Yeah.
Like, what do you think? And yeah, let's hear what Charlie has to say. That's probably what he had to say about it.
And here's another thing I'd like to flash on you guys. All you Johnny Carsons and all you comedians who get up there and tell jokes about Charlie Manson, what would you do? If I was in the same room with you, would you tell jokes about me then? I'd like to go on the Johnny Carson show. Sam, you know what this beard covers up, Johnny? You know what this beard covers? A hard
That's a solid punchline, Charles.
No, he's amazing.
I tell you what I'd do. I'd fucking scoop him up in my arms, and I'd give him a little kiss. I would pet his head, and I would pet his tiny beard.
I agree.
And here's what Charles had to say. This is when someone asked him, are you Jesus? Are you God? What do you think about God?
Well, God, I guess you're my best friend, being I invented you.
Because he invented him?
Sure, I believe myself. Why wouldn't I?
That's brilliant.
Which one?
Are you Jesus Christ?
Which Jesus? There's all kinds of Jesuses. There's a black Jesus down in Florida. He's having a good time. There's a Mexican Jesus in Mexico. I mean, there's all kinds of Jewish Jesus. I mean, Jesus, you know. There's all kinds of Jesus coming back everywhere. And nothing can stop it. It's a consciousness that lives in your mind. Da, 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 you know.
The more I listen to him, the more he makes fucking sense. He talks about even several speeches about how he's like, I don't live in this physical world. I live in the spiritual world. He's a very complex. I mean, of course, this is a very complex story.
Yes,
it's a long story. We got to the end of it.
Yeah, we got
Manson is safely behind bars, I guess.
Yeah.
Himself. He's protected.
Yeah, he's getting married.
Yeah, I think.
Yeah, as far as we know, him and Star are still getting married.
Yeah.
Yeah, his good old 25-year-old cute girl.
Yep. Well.
Yeah, and
also I'd like to say, so another thing too is for everybody, check out the documentary called The Source on Netflix to watch what happens of an actual successful cult founded by a guy named Jim Baker who changed his name to Father Yode. And imagine... Imagine the Manson family if they had literally millions of dollars, some of the most smoking hot men and women living in a mansion together. They produced 60 albums under the name Yahweh 13, this fucking killer psychedelic band that they did.
Yeah.
Take a look at it. Jim Baker, 6'4", beautiful dude, huge dude, jiu-jitsu master, named the world's strongest boy when he was 12 years old.
Wow.
Literally.
Not even a joke.
Well,
well, that's amazing, man. What a three-parter it was.
Yeah, this concludes our probably our longest episode ever.
Yep.
Ever.
So hopefully, I'm hope you've taken your shoes off at this point, and hopefully you got your shirt off. I am.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Almost totally nude.
Yes, you are. You have not been wearing a shirt this entire time.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, all right, everybody. Thanks so much for listening. I'll do a hail yourselves.
Hail Satan.
Hail Gein.
Will you please hail me before you go?
I mean, who's
somebody? Oh, us or the...
No, I'm just saying. Just saying in general. Please hail me.
Because I hail and, me is a...
Make constellations.
Oh, and don't forget to go to podsurvey.com /last, L-A-S-T. We're still getting the surveys in, so if you didn't do it last week, be sure to do it this week. And we're going to go out on... Oh, and be sure to go to iTunes, rate and review, all that type of stuff.
Please do. And find us on Twitter.
Yeah. Marcus Parks, Ben Kissel, Henry Loves You. And go buy a Last Podcast on the Left t-shirt. CaveComedyRadio.com/Last Podcast on the Left. And just one more thing before we go. If you are having thoughts about hurting yourself or somebody else, please tell somebody in your immediate vicinity as soon as you possibly can. Tell your family, tell your therapist, somebody who can help you in a very real world way. Please tell them as soon as you possibly can. If I cannot stress this enough, if you are thinking of hurting yourself or somebody else, please tell somebody before you do something that you cannot take back. But we're going to go out on some of Charlie's music. We're going to go out.
Played from a tape.
Yeah, playing from a tape. This is a song called Eyes of a Dreamer. Mango Selections, everyone.
You love this.
I love it so much. Listen to it twice today. Or the whole album.
Smile on your face. It's like a boy.